It would be easier just to shoot them from above. What kind of sport would that be? Gran asked in his gruff voice. Or is it just that you don't want blood on your new uniform, kid? Keel called over his shoulder. They stood beside the armored craft, looking across the moonlit dunes, where the two scrawny nomads stumbled away. As if they had any hope of escape, once a Harkonnen trooper decided to target them. Garan grabbed his weapon, and the three of them strode across the sands. The two Freeman youths scuttled like beetles, but the threat of the troops might cause them to turn around and surrender. Or better yet, fight like cornered rats. I've heard stories about these Freeman. Shostan panted as he kept up with the two older men. Their children are said to be killers, and their women will torture you in ways that even Peter de Vries couldn't imagine. Keel gave a rude snort of laughter. We've got laser guns, Jostan. What are they going to do, throw rocks at us? Some of them carry Maula pistols. Garan looked back at the young recruit, then gave a shrug. Why don't you go back to the Thopter and get our stunner, then? We can use a wide field if things get bad. Yeah, Keel said. That way we can make this last longer. The two white-clad freemen continued to flounder across the sand, and the Harkonnen troopers closed the distance with purposeful strides. Glad for the opportunity to be away from the fight, Jostan sprinted over the dune toward the waiting Thopter. From the dune top, he looked back at his companions, then rushed to the darkened craft. As he ducked inside, he encountered a man clad in desert tans, hands flicking across the controls with the speed of a snake on a hot plate. Hey, what are you... Jostan cried. In the cabin light, he saw that the figure had a narrow, leathery face. The eyes captivated him, blue within blue with the sharp intensity of a man accustomed to killing. Before Jostan could react, his arm was grabbed with a grip as strong as an eagle's talon, and he was dragged deeper into the cockpit. The Freeman's other hand flashed, and he saw a curved, milky blue knife strike up. A bright icicle of pain slashed into his throat, all the way back to his spine. Then the knife was gone before even a droplet of blood could cling to its surface. Like a scorpion that had just unleashed its sting, the Freeman backed up. Jostan fell forward, already feeling red death spreading from his throat. He tried to say something, to ask a question that seemed all important to him, but his words only came out as a gurgle. The Freeman snatched something from his stillsuit and pressed it against the young man's throat, an absorbent cloth that drank his blood as it spilled. Was the desert man saving him? A bandage? A flash of hope rose in Jostan's mind. Had it all been a mistake? Was this gaunt native trying to make amends? But Jostan's blood pumped out too quickly and forcefully for any medical help. As his life faded, he realized that the absorbent pack had never been meant as a wound dressing, but simply to capture every droplet of blood for its moisture. When Keel came within firing distance of the two Freeman youths, Garan looked back into the moonlight. I thought I heard something from the Thopter. Probably Jostan tripping on his own feet, the side gunner said, not lowering his weapon. The trapped Freeman staggered to a halt across a shallow pan of soft sand. They crouched and pulled out small, clumsy-looking knives. Keel laughed out loud. What do you mean to do with those? Pick your teeth? I'll pick the teeth from your dead body, one of the boys shouted. Got any old-fashioned gold molars we can sell in Arakeen? Garan chortled and looked at his companion. This is going to be fun. Moving in lockstep, the troopers marched into the flat, sandy area. As they closed to within 5 meters, the sand around them erupted. Human forms popped out of the dust, covered with grit, tan human silhouettes, like animated corpses boiling up from a graveyard. Garan let out a useless warning cry, and Keel fired once with his laser gun, injuring one of the men in the shoulder. Then the dusty forms surged forward. Clustering around the pilot, they pressed in so close that he couldn't bring his laser gun to bear. They attacked him like blood lice on an open wound. As they drove Garan to his knees, he cried out like an old woman. The Freeman restrained him so that he could do little more than breathe and blink his eyes. And scream. One of the white-clad victims hurried forward. The young man, Leet Kynes, held out the small knife that Garan and Keel had snickered at just moments ago. The youth darted downward, jabbing with the tip of the blade, but with precise control, as gentle as a kiss, to gouge out both of Garan's eyes, transforming his sockets into red Oedipal stains. Stilgar barked out a command. "Bind him and keep him. We shall bring this one back to Red Wall Siege alive, and let the women take care of him in their own way." Garan screamed again. When the Freeman rushed forward to attack Keel, the side gunner responded by swinging his weapon like a club. As clawing hands grabbed for it, he surprised them by releasing the laser rifle. The Freeman who clutched the gun fell backward, caught off balance by the unexpected action. Then Keel began to run. Fighting would do him no good. They had already taken Garan, and he assumed Jostin was dead back at the Thopter. So he left the Freeman, running as he had never run before. He sprinted across the night sands away from the rocks, away from the Thopter, and out into the open desert. The Freeman might be able to catch him, but he would give them a run for it. Panting, leaving his companions behind, Keel raced across the dunes with no plan and no thought other than to flee farther and farther away. "We've captured the Thopter intact still," Warwick said, flushed with adrenaline and quite proud of himself. The commando leader nodded grimly. Umma Kynes would be exceedingly pleased at the news. He could always use a Thopter for his agricultural inspections, and he didn't need to know where it came from. Leet looked down at the blinded captive, whose gouged eye sockets had been covered by a cloth. "I saw what the Harkonnens did to Bilar Camp with my own eyes. The poisoned cistern, the tainted water." The other body had already been packed in the rear of the patrol Thopter to be taken to the death stills. "This doesn't pay back a tenth part of the suffering." Going to his blood brother's side, Warwick made a face of disgust. "Such is my scorn that I don't even want to take their water for our tribe." Stilgar glowered at him as if he had spoken sacrilege. "You would prefer to let them mummify in the sands? To let their water go wasted into the air? It would be an insult to Shai-Hulud." Warwick bowed his head. "It was only my anger speaking still. I did not mean it." Stilgar looked up at the ruddy rising moon. The entire ambush had lasted less than an hour. "We shall perform the ritual of Tal-Hai, so that their souls will never rest. They will be damned to walk the desert for all eternity." Then his voice became harsh and fearful. "But we must take extra care to cover our tracks, so that we do not lead their ghosts back to our siege." The Freeman muttered as fear dampened their vengeful pleasure. Stilgar intoned the ancient chant, while others drew designs in the sand, labyrinthine power shapes that would bind the spirits of the cursed men to the dunes forever. Out across the moonlit sands, they could still see the clumsily running figure of the remaining trooper. "That one is our offering to Shai-Hulud," Stilgar said, finishing his chant. The Tal-Hai curse was complete. "The world will be at balance, and the desert will be pleased." "He's chugging like a broken crawler." Leet stood next to Stilgar, drawing himself up, though he was still small compared to the commando leader. It won't be long now. They gathered their supplies. As many as possible piled into the patrol thopter, while the remaining freemen slipped back across the sands. They used a well-practiced random gait, so that their footsteps made no sound that was not natural to the desert. The Harkonnen sidegunner continued to flee in a blind panic. By now he might be entertaining a hope of escape, though the direction of his flight across the ocean of dunes would take him nowhere. Within minutes, a worm came for him. The purpose of argument is to change the nature of truth. Bene Gesserit precept. In all his devious dealings, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen had never before felt such loathing for anyone. How could the Bene Gesserit bitch do this to me? One smoky morning on Gedi Prime, he entered the exercise room of his keep, locked the doors, and left orders not to be disturbed. Unable to use the weights or pulley equipment because of his increasing bulk, he sat on a floor mat and tried to perform simple leg lifts. Once he had been perfection in human form. Now he could barely raise each leg. Disgust enveloped him. For 2 months, ever since hearing Dr. Yue's diagnosis, he'd wanted to rip out Mohiam's internal organs one by one. Then, keeping her awake, jolted with life support systems, he would do interesting things while she watched. Burn her liver. Make the witch bitch eat her spleen. Strangle her with her own entrails. Now he understood Mohiam's smug expression at the Fenring banquet. She did this to me. He looked at himself in a floor-length mirror and recoiled. His face was puffy and swollen, slig ugly. Reaching up his heavy arms, he yanked the plas mirror off the wall and slammed it to the floor, twisting the unbreakable material out of shape so that his reflection became even more distorted. It was understandable that Mohiam might resent the rape, he supposed. But the witch had blackmailed him into the sexual act in the first place, demanding that he provide the damnable sisterhood with a Harkonnen daughter. Twice! It wasn't fair. He was the victim here. The Baron simmered and stewed and raged. He didn't dare let any of his rivals in the Landsrad learn of the cause. It was the difference between strength and weakness. If they continued to believe he had grown bloated and corpulent because of excess, through his own overindulgences to flaunt his success, he could retain his power. If, however, they learned he had been inflicted with a disgusting disease by a woman who had forced him to have sex with her, the Baron could not abide that. Yes, hearing Mohiam's screams would be a tasty revenge. But no more than a morsel, not sufficient for a man of his stature. She was only a repulsive appendage of the Bene Gesserit order itself. The witches considered themselves so superior, able to crush anyone, even the head of House Harkonnen. They must be punished, as a matter of family pride, a matter of asserting power and status in the name of the entire Landsrad. Besides, he would enjoy it. But if he acted precipitously, he would never wring a cure from them. The Sook doctor had claimed there was no known treatment for the disease, but it was in the hands of the Bene Gesserit. The sisterhood had done this to the Baron, and only they could restore his once beautiful body. Damn them! He needed to turn the tables, get into their diabolical minds and discover what lurked there. He would find a way to blackmail them. He would strip away their funereal black robes, figuratively, and leave them to stand naked, awaiting his judgment. He threw the bent mirror across the tile floor, where it skidded and slammed into an exercise machine. Without his walking stick, he lost his balance, slipped, and tumbled back to the mat. It was all too much to bear. After composing himself, the Baron hobbled into his cluttered workroom and summoned Peter de Vries. His voice boomed through the corridors, and servants dashed about, looking for the Mentat. For a full month, de Vries had been recovering from his foolish spice overdose. The idiot claimed to have seen a vision of House Harkonnen's downfall, but he'd been unable to offer any useful information as to how the Baron could combat such a dismal future. Now the Mentat could make up for his failure by devising a strike against the Bene Gesserit. Every time de Vries pushed the Baron too far, annoying him to the point of impending execution, he managed to prove himself indispensable again. "How do I hurt the witches? How do I cripple them? Make them squirm?" Still waiting, the Baron looked out of the keep, studying Harko City, with its oil-streaked buildings and hardly a tree in sight. Usually he liked this view, but now it added to his despondency. He chewed the inside of his mouth, felt the tears of self-pity recede. "I will crush the sisterhood." These women were not stupid. Far from it. With their breeding programs and their political machinations, they had bred intelligence into their own ranks. To improve on this even more, they had wanted his superior Harkonnen genes as part of their order. Oh, how he hated them! A careful plan would be required. Tricks within tricks. "My Lord Baron," Peter de Vries said, arriving silently. His voice rose from his throat like a viper slithering out of a pit. In the corridor outside, the Baron heard loud voices and a clattering of metal. Something thudded against a wall, and furniture crashed. He turned from the window to see his burly nephew stride through the doorway, right behind the Mentat. Even with normal footsteps, Glossu Rabban seemed to stomp across the floor. "I'm here, Uncle." "Obviously. Now leave us. I called Peter, not you." Normally, Rabban spent his time on Arrakis carrying out the Baron's wishes. But whenever he returned to Gedi Prime, he wanted to participate in every meeting, every discussion. The Baron took a deep breath, reconsidered. "On second thought, you may as well stay, Rabban. I need to tell you about this anyway." After all, this brute was his heir presumptive, the best hope for the future of House Harkonnen. Better than soft-headed Abelard, Rabban's father. How different they were, though each man had serious shortcomings. Like a pathetic puppy, his nephew smiled, happy to be included. "Tell me what, Uncle?" "That I'm going to have you put to death." Rabban's pale blue eyes dulled for a moment. Then he brightened. "No, you aren't." "How can you be so sure?" The Baron glowered, while the Mentat's darting eyes watched the interplay. Rabban responded promptly. "Because if you were really going to put me to death, you wouldn't warn me first." A smile stole across the Baron's plump face. "Perhaps you aren't a total fool after all." Accepting the compliment, Rabban slumped into a chair dog, squirming until the creature molded to his form. De Vries remained standing, observing, waiting. The Baron reiterated the details of the disease Mohiam had inflicted upon him, and his need for revenge against the Bene Gesserit. "We must come up with a way to get even with them. I want a plan. A delicious plan that will return the favor for us." De Vries stood with his effeminate features slack, his eyes unfocused. In Mentat mode, he rolled pattern searches through his mind at hyperspeed. His tongue darted over his red-stained lips. Rabban kicked the chair dog with his heel, adjusting to a different position. "Why not a full-scale military assault on Wallach 9? We can destroy every building on the planet." De Vries twitched, and for a fraction of a second he seemed to glance at Rabanne. But it was so quick that the Baron wasn't certain if it had occurred at all. He couldn't stand the notion of his nephew's primitive thoughts contaminating the finely tuned thinking processes of his valuable mentat. "Like a Seleucid bull at a dinner party, you mean?" the Baron said. "No, we require something with more finesse. Look up the definition in a dictionary, Slate, if the concept is unfamiliar to you." Rather than being offended, Rabanne leaned forward on the chair dog, narrowing his eyes. "We have the no-ship." Startled, the Baron turned to look at him. Just when he thought that Claude was too dull-witted even to join the house guard, Rabanne surprised him with an unexpected insight. They had dared use the experimental invisible ship only once, to destroy Tleilaxu vessels and frame the hapless young Duke Atreides. Because Rabanne had murdered the eccentric Rachesian inventor, they had no way of duplicating the technology. Even so, it was a weapon whose existence no one suspected, not even the witches. "Perhaps, unless Peter has a different idea."
"I do, my Baron."
De Vries's eyelids flickered, and the eyes came into focus. "Mentat summation," he said, in a voice that was more stilted than his normally smooth tone. "I have found a useful loophole in the law of the Imperium. Something most intriguing, my Baron." Like a law tech, he quoted it word for word, then recommended a plan. For a moment, all of the Baron's bodily aches and pains vanished in euphoria. He turned to his nephew. "Now do you see the potential, Rabanne? I would rather be known for finesse than brute force." Grudgingly, Rabanne nodded. "I still think we should take the no-ship, just in case." He himself had piloted the invisible warcraft and launched the attack that should have triggered a full-scale Atreides-Tleilaxu war. Not wanting to let the Mentat grow too smug, the Baron agreed. "It never hurts to have a backup plan." The preparations were swift and complete. Captain Kriubi insisted that his men follow Peter de Vries's instructions to the letter. Rabanne marched through the hangars and barracks like a warlord, maintaining an appropriate level of tension among the troops. Guild transport had already been summoned, while a Harkonnen frigate was stripped and loaded with more than its normal complement of men and weapons, along with the ultra-secret ship that had been used only once, a full decade earlier. From a military standpoint, the invisibility technology was a potential boon unlike any other in recorded history. Theoretically, it would let the Harkonnens deliver crushing blows to their enemies without being detected in any way. Imagine what Viscount Moritani of Grumman would pay for such an advantage. The unseen warcraft had functioned effectively on its maiden voyage, but further plans had been delayed while technicians repaired mechanical bugs that cropped up afterward. While most of the problems were minor, some, involving the no-field generator itself, proved more stubborn. And the Rachesian inventor was no longer alive to offer assistance. Nevertheless, the ship had performed well enough in recent tests, though the quavery-voiced mechanics warned that it might not be entirely battle-worthy. One of the slowest-moving cargo workers had had to be crushed gradually in a steam press to give sufficient incentive to his peers so that they would not miss the scheduled departure time. The Baron was in a hurry. The fully loaded frigate went into geostationary orbit over Wallach 9, directly above the Mother School complex. Standing on the bridge of the frigate with Peter de Vries and Glossu Rabanne, the Baron transmitted no signal to the Bene Gesserit headquarters. He didn't have to. "State your business," a female voice demanded over the comm system, stiff and unwelcoming. Did he detect an undertone of surprise? De Vries replied formally, "His Excellency the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen of Gedi Prime
wishes to speak with your mother superior on a private channel.
Not possible. No prior arrangements have been made.
The Baron leaned forward and boomed into the comm system.
You have 5 minutes to establish a confidential connection with your mother superior, or I will communicate on an open line. That could prove embarrassing.
The pause was longer this time.
Moments before the deadline, a different, rasping voice came over the speaker.
I am Mother Superior Harishka. We are on my personal comlink.
Good. Then listen carefully.
The Baron smiled. DeVries recited the case.
The Articles of the Great Convention are most explicit regarding certain serious crimes, Mother Superior. These laws were established in the wake of the horrors committed by thinking machines on humanity. One of the ultimate crimes is the use of atomics against human beings. Another is aggression by biological warfare.
Yes, yes, I am not a military historian, but I can get someone to quote the exact phrasing if you wish.
Does your mentat not take care of such bureaucratic details, Baron?
I don't see what this has to do with us.
Would you like me to tell you a bedtime story as well?
Her sarcasm could only mean she had begun to grow nervous.
The forms must be obeyed, the Baron quoted. The punishment for a violation of these laws is immediate annihilation of the perpetrators at the hands of the Landsrad. Every great house has sworn to deliver an overwhelming combined force against the offending party.
He paused, and his words became more menacing.
The forms have not been obeyed, have they, Mother Superior?
Peter DeVries and Rabban looked at each other, both grinning. The Baron continued.
House Harkonnen is prepared to bring a formal complaint before the Emperor and the Landsrad, charging the Bene Gesserit with the illegal use of biological weapons against a great house.
You speak nonsense. The Bene Gesserit have no aspirations of military power. She sounded entirely baffled. Was it possible she did not know?
Know this, Mother Superior. We have incontrovertible evidence that your Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam intentionally inflicted a biological scourge upon my person while I was providing a service demanded by the Sisterhood. Ask the bitch yourself, if your underlings keep such information from you.
The Baron did not mention that the Sisterhood had blackmailed him with information about illegal spice stockpiling activities. He was ready for that subject if it surfaced again, since all of his melange hordes had been moved to remote regions of distant Harkonnen worlds, where they would never be discovered. Contented, the Baron sat back, listening to the deep silence. He imagined the appalled horror on the old Mother Superior's face. He twisted the knife deeper.
If you doubt our interpretation, read the wording of the Great Convention again, and see if you care to risk it in open Landsrad court. Bear in mind, too, that the instrument of your attack, Reverend Mother Mohiam, was delivered to me on a guild ship. When the guild discovers that, they will not be pleased.
He tapped his fingertips on a console.
Even if your sisterhood is not demolished, you will receive severe sanctions from the Imperium, heavy fines, even banishment.
Finally, in a voice that almost managed to cover how the threat had shaken her, Harishka said,
You exaggerate your case, Baron, but I wish to be open-minded. What is it you want from us?
He could feel her squirm.
I will take a shuttle down to the surface and meet with you privately. Send up a pilot to shepherd us through your planetary defense systems.
He did not bother to point out his arrangements to transmit the evidence and accusations directly to Kaitane, should anything happen to them on this journey. The Mother Superior would already know.
Certainly, Baron, but you will realize soon this is all a terrible misunderstanding.
Just produce Mohiam at the meeting, and be prepared to provide me with an effective treatment and cure. or else you and your sisterhood have no hope of surviving this debacle."
The ancient Mother Superior remained unimpressed. "How large is your entourage?"
"Tell her we have a whole army," Rabban whispered to his uncle.
The Baron shoved him away.
"Myself and 6 men.
"Your request for a meeting is granted."
When the link was shut down, Rabban asked, "Can I go, Uncle?"
"Do you remember what I said to you about finesse?"
"I looked up the word and all of its definitions, as you commanded."
"Stay here and think about it while I confer with the Witch Mother."
Angrily, Rabban stomped away.
An hour later, a Bene Gesserit lighter docked with the Harkonnen frigate. A narrow-faced young woman with wavy chestnut hair stepped onto the entry dock. She wore a slick black uniform.
"I am Sister Christine. I will guide you to the surface."
Her eyes glittered.
"Mother Superior awaits."
The Baron marched forward with 6 hand-picked armed soldiers. Peter de Vries spoke in a low voice that the witch could not hear.
"Never underestimate the Bene Gesserit, my Baron."
With a grunt, the Baron strode past his mentat and boarded the lighter.
"Not to worry, Peter. They're under our thumb now."
Religion is the emulation of the adult by the child. Religion is the insistment of past beliefs. Mythology, which is guesswork, the hidden assumptions of trust in the universe, those pronouncements which men have made in search of personal power, all mingled with shreds of enlightenment. And always the ultimate unspoken commandment is, "Thou shalt not question." But we do anyway. We break that commandment as a matter of course. The work to which we have set ourselves is the liberating of the imagination, the harnessing of imagination to humankind's deepest sense of creativity.
Credo of the Bene Gesserit Sisterhood.
A beautiful woman confined to a desolate world, Lady Margaret Fenring did not complain about the starkness, miserable heat, or lack of amenities in the dusty garrison town. Arakeen was situated on a hard salt pan, with the inhospitable desert stretching off to the south and higher elevations, including the rugged shield wall, rising to the northwest. Since it was a few kilometers beyond the uncertain worm line, the settlement had never been attacked by one of the great sandworms, but this was still a subject of occasional concern. What if something changed? Life on the desert planet was never entirely secure. Margaret thought of the sisters who had been lost there while working for the Missionaria Protectiva. Long ago they had gone off into the desert, following the orders of Mother Superior, never to be seen again. Arakeen was immersed in the rhythms of the desert, the dryness and the premium put on water, the ferocious storms that blew in like great winds across a vast sea, the legends of danger and survival. Margaret felt great serenity and spirituality here. It was a haven where she could contemplate nature, philosophy, and religion, far from the inane bustle of the imperial court. She had time to do things in this place, time to discover herself. What had those lost women found? In the lemon glow of dawn, she stood on a second-floor balcony of the residency. Fine dust and grit filtered the rising sun and gave the landscape a new look, leaving deep shadows where creatures concealed themselves. She watched a desert hawk fly toward the sun-drenched horizon, flapping its wings with slow power. The sunrise was like an oil painting by one of the great masters, a wash of pastels that sharply defined the rooftops of the town and the shield wall. Somewhere out there, in countless sieges nestled in the rocky wasteland,
dwelled the elusive Freeman. They had the answers she needed, the essential information Mother Superior Harishka had pressed her to obtain. Had the desert nomads listened to the teachings of the Missionaria Protectiva? Or had they simply killed the messengers and stolen their water? Behind her, the recently completed conservatory had been sealed with an airlock that opened only for her. Count Fenring, still asleep in their bedroom, had helped her to obtain some of the most exotic plants in the Imperium. But they were for her eyes alone. Lately, she'd heard rumors of a Freeman dream for a green Arrakis, typical Edenic myths of the type often spread by the Missionaria Protectiva. That could have been an indication of the missing sisters. It was not unusual, however, for a struggling people in a harsh environment to develop their own dreams of paradise, even without Bene Gesserit prompting. It would have been interesting to discuss the stories with planetologist Kynes, perhaps ask him who the Freeman's mysterious Uma might be. She could not imagine how all this might be connected. The Desert Hawk rose on thermals and soared. Still standing at the balcony window, Margaret took a sip of melange tea from a small cup. The soothing glow of its spicy essence filled her mouth. Though she had lived on Arrakis for a dozen years, she consumed spice only in moderation, careful not to become addicted enough that her eye color altered. In the mornings, though, melange enhanced her ability to perceive the natural beauty of Arrakis. She'd heard it said that melange never tasted the same twice, that it was like life, changing each time one partook of it. Change was an essential concept here, a key to understanding the Freeman. Superficially, Arrakis appeared always the same, a wasteland stretching into the unending distance and into infinite time. But the desert was so much more than that. Margaret's Freeman housekeeper, the shout-out Mapes, had suggested as much one day. "Arrakis is not what it seems, my lady." Tantalizing words. Some said the Freeman were strange, suspicious, and smelly. Outsiders spoke with a critical eye and sharp tongue, with no compassion or any attempt to understand the indigenous population. Margaret, though, viewed the Freeman oddness as intriguing. She wanted to learn about their fiercely independent ways, to understand how they thought and how they survived here. If she got to know them better, she could perform her job more effectively. She could learn the answers she needed. Studying the Freeman who worked in the mansion, Margaret recognized barely discernible identifiers in body language, vocal inflection, odor. If the Freeman had anything to say, and if they thought you deserved to hear it, they would tell you. Otherwise, they went about their chores diligently, with heads bowed, disappearing into the tapestry of their society afterward like grains of sand in the desert. In her search for answers, Margaret had considered stating her questions outright, demanding any information about the missing sisters, hoping the household servants would take her request out into the desert. But she knew the Freeman would simply vanish, refusing to be coerced. Perhaps she should expose her own vulnerabilities to gain their trust. The Freeman would be shocked at first, then confused, and possibly even willing to cooperate with her. "My only duty is to the sisterhood. I am a loyal Bene Gesserit." But how to communicate without being obvious, without raising suspicions? She considered writing a note and leaving it in a place where it was sure to be found. The Freeman were always listening, always gathering information in their furtive ways. No, Margaret would have to be subtle, and also treat them with respect. She would have to tantalize them. Then she remembered an odd practice that came to her through centuries of other memory. Or was it just a bit of trivia she had read while studying on Wallach 9? No matter. On old Terra, in an honor-based society known as Japan, there had been a tradition of hiring ninja assassins, quiet yet effective, in order to dodge legal entanglements. When a person wished to engage the services of the shadowy killers, he would go to a designated wall, face it, and whisper the name of the target and the fee offered. Though never seen, the ninja were always listening, and a contract was made. Here in the residency, the Freemen, too, were always listening. Margaret tossed her blonde hair over her shoulder, loosened her cool, slick-weave garment, and stepped into the hall outside of her offices. In the immense mansion, even in the cool early morning, people moved about, cleaning, dusting, polishing. Margaret stood in the central atrium and looked up toward the high-arched ceiling. She spoke in a soft, directed voice, knowing that the architecture of the old residency created a whisper gallery. Some would hear her in random places. She didn't know who, nor did she look to identify them. The Bene Gesserit sisters, whom I represent here, hold the utmost respect and admiration for Freeman Ways, and I personally am interested in your affairs. She waited for the faint echoes to die away. If anyone could hear me, perhaps I have information to share about the Lisan al-Ghaib, information you do not know at this time. The Lisan al-Ghaib, or voice from the outer world, was a Freeman myth concerning a messianic figure, a prophet who bore striking parallels with the sisterhood's own plans. Obviously, some prior representative of the Missionaria Protectiva had planted the legend as a precursor to the arrival of the Bene Gesserit's Kwisatz Haderach. Such preparation had been done on countless worlds in the Imperium. Her comments were sure to spark Freeman interest. She saw a flitting shadow, a drab robe, leathery skin. Later that day, upon observing the Freeman employees moving about their household tasks, Margaret thought they stared at her with a different kind of intensity, assessing her rather than just averting their blue-within-blue eyes. Now, she began to wait, with the supreme patience of a Bene Gesserit. Humiliation is a thing never forgotten. Rebecca of Ginaz. The next island of the Ginaz school was the remnant of an ancient volcano, a bleak scab raised out of the water and left to dry in the tropical sun. The settlement inside the bowl of the dry crater looked like another penal colony. Duncan stood in formation on the stony exercise field with 110 other young men, including the red-headed Grumman trainee, Hiyi Resser. Of the original 150, 39 had not completed their initial testing. The curly black hair on Duncan's head had been shaved, and he wore the loose black gi of the school. Each student carried whatever weapon he'd brought to Ginaz, and Duncan had the old Duke's sword,